Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Vandana Shiva. Vandana is a world-renowned advocate for environmental sanity and the well-being and liberation of farmers and the rural poor. She's director of the Research Foundation on Science, Technology, and Ecology, and author of many best-selling books, including Stolen Harvest, The Hijacking of the Global Food Supply, and Soil, Not Oil. Vandana is founder of Navdanya, or Nine Seeds, which is a movement promoting diversity and use of native seeds, and a recipient of the Right Livelihood Award, often called the Alternative Nobel Prize. Forbes named Vandana one of the seven most powerful women on the globe. Time selected her as an environmental hero, and Asia Week has called her one of the five most powerful communicators in Asia. So now, Vandana, we are so excited for this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Vandana, for being with us once again.
It's a joy to return to your summit.
You know, industrial food production today has become almost totally dependent on chemicals worldwide. And the justification for using them, toxic though they may be, is always about maximizing yield per acre. But focusing exclusively on yield per acre completely ignores the health value of the food that's produced. It ignores the costs of chemical inputs, which trap farmers in debt. And it ignores the impact of these chemicals on the soil organisms that keep soil fertile and the gut bacteria we need to stay healthy. Vandana, you've proposed an entirely different way of thinking, which focuses instead on health per acre or nutrition per acre. So what I want to ask you is this. When agricultural output is measured in terms of health per acre or nutrition per acre instead of yield per acre, do we find that organic farming systems actually have a greater output than industrial monocultures?
Well, they absolutely do. Not only are we talking about not counting the high cost, not counting the damage to the soil and our health in the yield per acre measurement, you're not even taking into account the full output of a healthy farming system in terms of the food we eat. When I started to assess the total output of biodiverse systems, we find that the ecological biodiverse systems not only produce more food, they produce more nutritious food. And our figures are showing that if farming was done ecologically, respecting the earth, recognizing the laws that make us healthy, and recognizing the ecological laws that keep the soil renewed and prevent climate damage, we add it all together, the benefit is that we actually can feed two times the world population. There wouldn't be nearly a billion people starving, and there wouldn't be the kind of diseases of malnutrition, including nutrient deficiencies we are seeing, and the gut problems we are seeing because of the combination of lack of nutrition through diversity, because of millions and millions and trillions of bacteria need different food. Each of them is designed for a different diet. Each soil organism is designed for a different diet. And I think we have to start putting diversity to the center of our thinking. I've always said the yield per acre mischief of only measuring a commodity that flows into the global trading system while ruining the planet and our health is actually an alternative fact.
An alternative fact. It really is. That used to be called a myth or a delusion or a lie, but we now have this new language.
We have a new language. Some of it is helpful.
All right. There have been two very recent UN reports, and I want to describe them both, and then I want to ask you a very serious question. The first one, UN food and pollution experts told the Security Council that the idea that pesticides are essential to feed the world, the essential to feed a fast-growing global population, is a myth. And the report also accused the global corporations that manufacture pesticides of systematically denying the harms caused by their chemicals and of aggressive, unethical marketing tactics. Their report concluded that pesticides are having catastrophic impacts on the environment, on human health, and on society as a whole, including causing 200,000 deaths a year from acute poisoning. Now, that's one report. In the second report, a UN official told the UN Security Council that the world is now facing the worst humanitarian crisis since 1945. 20 million people, he said, are now facing potential starvation, mainly in Yemen, South Sudan, Somalia, and Nigeria. Vandana, the pesticide companies like Monsanto, are constantly telling us they're feeding the world and we need their products or else there will be mass hunger. My question for you is this. What goes through your mind and heart when you hear the claims made by the companies that manufacture pesticides, companies like Monsanto, that they are feeding the world?
Well, you know, this wasn't my field, John. I hadn't chosen to study agriculture. I'd chosen to study physics and did a PhD in the foundations of quantum theory on the issues of non-separability and non-locality. And I was literally pushed into trying to understand what's going on with agriculture with two disasters in India. One was Punjab, which absolutely erupted in violence. And the same year, we had the Bhopal disaster, where a pesticide plant leaked and killed between 3,000 to 7,000 people. The estimates are different according to the sources immediately, and thousands since then, and hundreds of thousands are crippled for life. Now, not only do I totally support the Special Rapporteur's report on the harm of pesticides, I'm so glad she took this issue up because it has been ignored for a very, very long time. But the two reports are connected because my work on Punjab, on the Green Revolution, showed me that a chemical agriculture dependent on chemical fertilizers and pesticides, which came out of the war, is the same agriculture that desertifies soils, is the same agriculture that depletes water. Look at Lake Chad. Look at the soil water holding capacity. That's what desertification is about. We even have a UN treaty on land degradation and desertification, but it's treated like it doesn't exist. In my view, it's the most significant UN treaty. We did a manifesto called Terra Viva to try and understand the refugee crisis. And if you look at the hordes of refugees, all the problems begin with a chemical industrial monoculture farming model that for a while gets huge commodities flowing into the market, devastates local ecosystems, uproots communities, creates conflicts. And that is at the root of the hunger and famine that the UN is trying to wake us to. So the direct killing by the pesticides and the indirect killings by a system that must literally consume society and devastate agrarian societies. Let's not forget, there was a drought in 2002 in southern Africa. And a very big issue then was the drought in agriculture. The United Nations set up an international assessment for agricultural science, technology, and development. More than 400 scientists worked over 6 years. Every agency of the world supported them. And they showed that chemical farming and genetic engineering cannot feed the world. We'll have to turn to agroecology. So the knowledge is there, just being suppressed. You know, not only is the pesticide industry killing people, it is killing science. It just does not allow the truth of the harm to come out. Look at the way Monsanto has handled the Roundup and glyphosate question.
Well, glyphosate, of course, is the primary active ingredient in the herbicide Roundup, and it's become now the most widely used farm chemical in the history of the world. The UN's International Agency for Research on Cancer has formally called glyphosate probably carcinogenic to humans, and they reached that conclusion after reviewing a huge number of independent peer-reviewed studies. We've seen an enormous increase in glyphosate use as a direct result of Monsanto genetically engineering crops to tolerate the herbicide. Vandana, what effect is this having, this massive use of glyphosate, of Roundup, on people, on the planet, on the whole living Earth community?
Well, three issues come to my mind immediately, John. The first is that no matter how much Monsanto denies the harm of glyphosate, the harm is taking place, which is why Sri Lanka, after the government research agencies found that there was an epidemic of kidney failure in areas where Roundup was being used as a weedicide, they called for a ban. Look at what has happened to Argentina in terms of the health disaster that country is facing. We actually organized a tribunal on Monsanto. The Monsanto tribunal was triggered by the fact that in India, Monsanto, by collecting illegal royalties, has pushed farmers into debt and suicide. It's pushed children into becoming victims of cancer at a very high rate, where the herbicide is actually sprayed in Argentina. And in the United States, look at the emergence of superweed, where you can't do farming anymore. And what is the solution of this mind, which I've called, as you know, not just the monoculture of the mind, I think we have to call it the militarized mind. The solution to the creation of superweeds like the Palmer amaranth that has now become resistant to Roundup is let's exterminate the amaranth through the new gene drive technologies. And so I wrote a piece on this. And the footnote is, yes, there'll be a little impact on food security. The Indians eat amaranth. But we don't just eat amaranth. For us, amaranth is a sacred food, as it is for the Mexicans. I would add that the fact that Monsanto has this lethal chemical that every responsible agency is saying should be banned is spreading it not just through the genetically engineered crops that are tolerant to Roundup. We have just caught Monsanto trying to illegally introduce a Roundup-ready cotton in India. It's not allowed. They don't have permission. Even the BT cotton, they came in illegally, and I had to sue them. We're preparing for a big campaign. But I think at the Food Summit, John, the biggest concern is they're spreading the use of Roundup as a desiccant, a drying of crops faster. And can you imagine every bit of wheat we are eating? The Roundup is being sprayed as a desiccant, and I do feel we need a campaign to stop the use, to ban the use of Roundup. We should have a campaign to Roundup. But I really feel we should. But the desiccation issue, I think, is criminal. I don't think they ever got permission for it, and they're using it without approval all over the world.
For our listeners, I'll explain a bit what the desiccation issue is that you're talking about. It's become common wheat harvest protocol to drench wheat fields with Roundup several days before the combine harvesters work through the fields. It's done because when the wheat is dried out or desiccated, it allows for an earlier and easier harvest. Many wheat farmers now are desiccating non-organic wheat crops with Roundup just before harvest. And as a result, much of the non-organic wheat is now contaminated with Roundup's active ingredient glyphosate, a chemical known to cause cancer in humans, which is another reason, if you're going to eat wheat, to be sure that it is organically grown.
Yeah, John, one more thing I'm remembering now. I did a book collecting articles and papers from all of them, and it's called Seed Sovereignty and Food Security, Women and the Vanguard. And there's a paper by MIT woman scientist, Stephanie Sennett, where she has shown that Roundup acts by disrupting what is called the shikimate pathway. And the way Monsanto got away saying it's safe is they said humans don't have this pathway. Humans have the pathway, just that human cells don't. But human cells are a tiny percentage of our body. The big percentage is bacteria. The bacteria have the shikimate pathway. So when we are eating that sprayed wheat, not only are we getting allergies, our basic gut biome is getting damaged, and we need that gut bacteria, not just for healthy functioning of the body, but of the brain. The neurotransmitters are produced by the amino acids that these bacteria are producing. So the rise in autism, the rise in neurological disorders, I mean, we are really talking of humanity being attacked in ways that it's not being allowed to know, because these are criminal corporations that suppress science, manipulate the media, and hijack our governments.
They do, and the same chemicals that that damage soil fertility by killing off the soil microorganisms that are necessary for soil to be fertile, are damaging the microbiome in our intestines, within our bodies, that we depend on to be creative, healthy, functional people. It's a staggering thing that the same chemicals that are damaging the soil and therefore impairing and compromising and jeopardizing food security for everyone are also causing so much problems to our personal health, to the bodies, and our ability to even think clearly.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm thinking of another report on GMOs. You wrote the introduction to it. It's based on field research around the world, and it's titled "The GMO Emperor Has No Clothes."
Right.
Yeah, and for those of our listeners who might not be familiar with the phrase "the emperor has no clothes," let me explain for a moment. It comes from a story by Hans Christian Andersen. It's about an emperor who hires two tailors who promise to make him a set of remarkable new clothes that will be invisible to anyone who is either incompetent or stupid. When the emperor goes to see his new clothes, he sees nothing at all because the tailors actually are swindlers and they haven't actually made him any clothes. But the emperor is afraid of being judged incompetent or stupid, so he pretends to be delighted with the new clothes. And he then wears them in a grand parade through the town. He's actually parading around naked. But the townspeople, themselves afraid of being judged as incompetent or stupid, pretend to see them. And they all say, "Oh, what beautiful clothes the emperor is wearing." Until a child yells out, "He hasn't got any clothes on." And after that, the emperor arrogantly continues parading around naked as though there was no problem. Now today, people who point out the emptiness of the pretensions of powerful people and institutions are often compared to the child in Hans Christian Andersen's fable, the child who said, "The emperor has no clothes." Now, Vandana, in what way is Hans Christian Andersen's fable an apt parody for what is happening today with genetically modified organisms in food and agriculture?
Well, I think the first way in which it's so relevant is because the child could speak the truth in his innocence. He hadn't been brainwashed into thinking that he had to lie. He had to engage in alternative fact-making in order to be respected in society. And that purity, innocence, and truth that came from the mouth of that child has to come from each one of us, to not be drowned out by the overwhelming propaganda machine, which is sadly what science in corporate hands has become, but even more seriously, what representative electoral democracy in the hands of big money has become. It is nothing but a giant propaganda machine. And this is the time we need our innocence, our purity of a direct relationship with lived experience to see for ourselves what's going on. If the emperor is naked, let's have the power to say the emperor has no clothes.
Yes, and in with genetically engineered food in particular, there are so many myths that are propagated by the what you're calling the giant propaganda machine that people then take on as truth. They believe them. They think that these are established scientific fact. They think, in fact, and Monsanto will say often again, that there is a scientific consensus about these things when there is, in fact, no such consensus. What are some of the myths about genetically engineered foods that are being propagated by the propaganda machine that we need to be able to see for what they really are?
Well, the first myth, of course, is that without GMOs, we won't feed the world. Just like they said, without pesticides, we won't feed the world. And pesticides don't increase any production. They just increase the toxic load. GMOs, as a technology, cannot increase production because the production comes from the original plant into which a genetic engineering and genetically engineered trait is introduced through only two methods so far, the gene gun and the agrobacterium. So the technology doesn't allow for yield increase, and yet this becomes their mantra of saying, without GMOs, the world will starve. The second big myth was that they would reduce chemicals. They said GMOs will be an alternative to chemical use. Instead, we've seen not only chemicals increasing because plants have been made resistant to Roundup, so Monsanto says the Roundup and the patented seed, but even in countries like India where they brought in BT cotton in the name of controlling pests and reducing pesticide use has increased, and the farmers' debt is connected to Monsanto collecting illegal royalties, leaving our farmers so deeply trapped in debt that the epidemic farmer suicide started, not only for the seeds, but also for the pesticides they're having to use. And the pesticides aren't working. In fact, the genetic engineering technologies create pests. The whitefly epidemic is a creation of BT cotton. It didn't exist in cotton before that. Because the plant is made vulnerable, the plant is not able to do its normal work of resisting pests. Plants are intelligent beings. They release chemicals when a pest attacks them. They know how to defend themselves. Just like human beings used to be intelligent beings, but we are also forgetting very fast how to protect ourselves.
Well, I hear you saying that the idea that GMOs are feeding the world is a myth, and that GMOs have, in fact, already led to large-scale destruction of biodiversity and to farmers' livelihoods and even contributed to the wave of farmer suicides in India. Vandana, can you help us to understand what it means that our food freedom, our food democracy, our food sovereignty are all at stake here?
Well, you know, I happen to have been at a meeting where the corporations, the chemical corporations, the pesticide industry laid out very clearly on how and why they would use the tools of recombinant DNA, the basis of genetic engineering. First, they said this gives us a chance to claim that we have done something new, and we can now take patents, and the money we can take from patenting seeds and through royalties will be much bigger than what we earn from selling chemicals. And their dream was by the year 2000, there'll only be GMOs in the world, and farmers will be paying them royalties for every crop. Thank goodness movements grew at that time. We built Navdanya, we built a seed freedom movement. The idea was also that they had to run a race of behaving like a cancer cell. You know, only the cancer cell doesn't know when to stop growing. Now, most of the seed industry was local. They were small firms. Before the toxic industry, the chemical industry, I call them the poison cartel, started to take over the local seed industry. And now there are really three players in the market, the poison cartel. Monsanto is merging with Bayer. Syngenta is merging with ChemChina. And Dow is merging with DuPont. Why do they have to keep getting bigger? Because through getting bigger, they start to behave more powerful than all the agencies of the world and all the democratically elected governments of the world. So they want to be the rulers of the world. And one of the other myths that goes hand in hand with this push is the claim of invention. You can only take a patent on something you have invented. You can invent machines, but you cannot invent a plant. You can tamper with a plant. You can contaminate a plant. You can modify a plant, but you don't invent a plant from scratch. That's why I sometimes joke and say, well, for Monsanto, GMO means God, move over. We are now going to take the role of creator, and we will collect rents from life. And it's not an accident that Monsanto really drove the intellectual property clauses in the World Trade Organization. The very idea of patents on seed, an attempt to introduce it at the global level, because I happen to have been involved at that early time. I could work with my government, I could work with our parliament, and India's laws do not allow plants and animals to be patented. Seeds are not patentable. So now what does Monsanto do? It starts to attack our laws. It starts to attack the laws in Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, wherever we say life forms are not inventions. And in the cases in India, as well as in Argentina, the argument is BT cotton is not a cotton seed. And they want to create a rhetoric of a technology product, even though the farmers buy it as a seed and plant it as a seed. In Argentina, they're saying Roundup Ready soya is not a soya. So you cannot regulate us. Every acre planted brings royalties to these corporations. That's the only reason we see the spread of soya and corn and cotton and canola, because these are the four crops in which they could do genetic engineering. That royalty collection is what's driving them, but that royalty collection is what's also making them destroy our food freedom in three ways. The first is that when large acreages, 95% of the corn and soy of the U.S. is now GMO. So if you eat products harvested from the crop of this country, that's what you're eating. Your choice is taken away. Second, when states like California, Colorado, Washington, Oregon try to get labeling done, that is destroyed through the paying for advertisement. But even a state like Vermont, which actually passes a law on labeling, it is overruled by the Dark Act passed by Congress. And the same people who are running the government now in this country are the ones who worked on undermining the right to know of the American citizens. The Dark Act is a way of describing the act that takes away the labeling, called the denial to Americans of the right to know, a word given by activists. But there's a third way in which our choice is taken away. When these monocultures are pushed, the biodiversity disappears. And the possibility to have healthy food, the diverse food that the soil needs, that our gut needs, starts to disappear. That's why seed freedom and food freedom go hand in hand, and both of them go hand in hand with fighting these toxic corporate giants. And I want to inform you, we will be taking out a pilgrimage timed with 100 years of when Gandhi joined the movement to say no to the compulsory planting of indigo in India for the mills of England. Farmers were dying of hunger. They weren't allowed to grow their own food. Gandhi came in and did his first Indian civil disobedience. He'd done many in South Africa before that. And so 100 years later, we're celebrating 30 years of our saying no to Monsanto's myths, to their GMOs, to their patents, and saying we will continue to grow our biodiverse seeds. We will continue to grow our food without your poisons. We will create larger and larger food freedom zones where we can eat food grown in healthy ways. And that means we have to start reinventing our food economy. And it'll only come from citizens and only come through solidarity.
When you mentioned biodiversity a moment ago, I was thinking about the reality that we have entered what many scientists are calling Earth's sixth mass extinction. And this is the only one in the billions of years of life on this planet to be caused by a single creature, in this case, a two-legged one. Now, we know that healthy ecosystems depend on biodiversity, and we know that without the services that healthy ecosystems provide to human beings, our access to food, to water, and to health are all impaired. I've often thought that the phrase, save the planet, is an expression of arrogance. The planet was here before we arrived, and it's going to be here long, long after we're gone. But if this planet is going to continue to be a viable place for humanity, and if we're going somehow to arrest the current wave of extinctions, we must entirely rethink our food system, and we've got to acknowledge our responsibilities to the entire Earth community. Vandana, you're at the forefront of these movements. Can you help our listeners to understand what is at stake when we seek to protect healthy ecosystems and biodiversity? How important that is?
Well, the first reason it's important is it's biodiversity that weaves the web of life. And how we grow our food is a total determinant of the health of the planet. 75% of the destruction of soil, of water, is related to industrial agriculture. About 93% of the disappearance of diversity of cultivated crops is related to industrial farming. India used to grow 200,000 varieties of rice. Thank goodness we started the work early enough. We have saved more than 3,000, including those that can tolerate salt and are necessary in these times of climate change as the cyclones and hurricanes grow, or seeds that are tolerant to drought because we're going to see more intensification of drought, but also delicious seeds. the biodiversity of farmer evolved varieties are based on diversity, nutrition, health, taste, and resilience, whereas the corporate breeding as well as GMOs is based on uniformity and vulnerability. Very, very bad idea in times of climate change. And my book, Soil Not Oil, I wrote it when I realized that 50% of all greenhouse gases driving climate change are coming from this model of farming. But 75% of the disappearance of bees, of the soil organisms, of the birds that didn't sing, which is what made Rachel Carson write Silent Spring. Whether we grow food to nourish the planet and our health, or we grow food to push species to extinction, destroy the planet, and destroy our own health, is a choice each one of us makes on an everyday basis. We've been made to believe that biodiversity only exists when we set a piece of forest aside. That's not true, because biodiversity is on our farms. It's in the soil when we nourish the soil. And I think we've reached a stage, John, that if we do not wake up, that we are members of one earth family, interwoven in our life, a common life, we will continue not just to destroy other species, but our own future. And that's why I keep talking about earth democracy. We are put on this planet to nourish the earth. She will take care of us if we do a little bit.
If we see ourselves as part of this magnificent web of life on earth, this beautiful, spectacularly complex web of life, this living earth community, of which we are a part, to which we owe our lives, for which we have to care if we're going to have a future. And yet there are these forces, and there are particular companies with names, there are men, there are individuals with names and addresses who are driving the extinctions and driving us in the direction of just catastrophe. You mentioned earlier these mergers, Dow and DuPont, Syngenta and the Chinese National Chemical Corporation, Bayer and Monsanto. These are all pending mergers. They're enormous. The merger between Monsanto and the German company Bayer is something like $66 billion. If it's approved and the Trump administration clearly favors it, the resulting company would own about 30% of the global seed market, 25% of the global pesticide market. And in addition to market control, this merger is aimed at something else too, I think. It's aimed at steadying the image of Monsanto, which is reeling. The company has become mired in turmoil from a long list of objectionable activities, toxic pesticides, and its increasingly unpopular GMO foods. But Vanda, I find it very strange to see Bayer being portrayed as the one riding to the rescue of Monsanto's poor public image, given Bayer's own terrible past, which includes Nazi sympathizing and marketing heroin-laced cough syrup to children.
Absolutely. In fact, I've just done a new book. I finished the new book. It's to be published. And I'm calling it The Resurgence of the Real. Because I think what's happened is we've created fictions that have become instruments of control by real people, of course. But corporations, a corporation is a fiction. We give it power. And now they want to claim personhood. But the most important issue is there's a handful of people owning all of these corporations now. There's one investment fund called Vanguard, which has jumped from being $3 trillion last year to being $4 trillion this year, when 388 men controlled half the wealth of the world 6 years ago, and it dropped to 62 last year, and it looked already to a smaller number. This year, it has dropped to 8. We are talking about such unaccountable wealth concentration. And while we know the name of companies, the name of those investors stay invisible. And that, to me, is the challenge of democracy today, because that's precisely the money, that invisible money, which becomes dark money and decides the shape of outcomes of elections. Elections are no more about people voting with enlightened sense of what is good for them. It is now money creating a propaganda machine to win an election.
I want to repeat something you just said. I want to make sure our listeners get it. Not that long ago, 360 or so people had as much wealth as the lower half, the bottom half of the world's population, 3.5 billion people. Already an egregious inequality of wealth, an egregious, a deplorable concentration of wealth in the hands of a few. But now it is only 6 men who have as much money, who control as much wealth as 3.5 billion people. When it becomes that disproportionate, that obscenely, grotesquely disproportionate, we have placed the world's fate in the hands of a few often exceedingly greedy, selfish people. What can happen then? It seems like we have established a script that will play out at tremendous misfortune to all of humanity.
And we have to avoid it, and each of us can. We can begin with our food.
And eating organic food. Eating
organic, knowing the farmer who grows it. In fact, helping farming communities grow. Because we'll have to create new farmers too. The last generation of farmers is being wiped out through debt, through mortgages. We need to now see food as our commons. We need to see food communities as the place where we grow democracy.
You know, one thing that I find hopeful, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization says that planting more lentils and chickpeas and other beans and legumes will improve the health of the world's soils. And this is obviously a critical thing to do because the state of the world's soils has become a serious problem, threatening to worsen hunger and poverty levels. The FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, said recently that about a third of the world's soils are degraded because of soil erosion and contamination and other issues. Now, planting legumes can really help because lentils and beans and other legumes transfer nitrogen from the atmosphere into the soil. They also can be grown practically anywhere. They're not fastidious plants to grow. And to me, it's really beautiful. We have nutritionists telling us that legumes are excellent sources of protein and of fiber and of many essential minerals and phytochemicals. And we have soil scientists telling us that soils and legumes create a unique symbiosis that protects the environment, that enhances soil productivity, that mitigates climate change, and that provides fundamental nutrients to the soil and to subsequent crops. So, Vandana, are beans and lentils and other legumes, these humble plants, part of the answer not only to the world's protein needs, but also to the fertility needs of the world's soils?
They absolutely are. And, you know, India wasn't a stupid civilization to have centered its diet on the dals, the pulses. And the British, of course, didn't know what to do with this and named all our pulses as animal feed. So it became chickpea, pigeon pea, cow pea, horse gram. When I started saving seeds and I'd look for the English word, I said, why is it all animal feed? Because they just didn't know what to do with these wonderful foods. And our peasants had known that these leguminous crops fix nitrogen for free. I call them the Gandhian plants because they're not violent, unlike the synthetic fertilizers, which are violent in the making, which are violent in their consequences. They emit nitrogen oxide, which is 300 times more destabilizing for the climate than carbon dioxide. And then they run off into the water and create dead zones. They're spreading death everywhere, whereas pulses spread life.
You know, I think you just answered a question that I've had for many years. I've not known the answer to it. I've always wondered, why are garbanzo beans also called chickpeas? And I think you just told me.
Yeah. When they came to India, they called it chickpea. The Spanish and the Italians continue to call them garbanzo beans.
You know, I want to ask you one final question. We've touched on the topic, but I want to bring another aspect of it into our conversation. The right to adequate food is part of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the International Covenant on Economic, Cultural, and Social Rights. And I want to emphasize that these are legally binding agreements. They're not just idealistic thinking. They established the legal basis for access to nutritionally healthy food as a human right. Now, in countries that have ratified these agreements, and most countries have, lawsuits can be brought to defend the right to adequate food. Cases affirming the right to food have been successful in Nepal, India, Brazil, El Salvador, South Africa, Germany, many countries. But the United States has not ratified these agreements. And as a result, in the United States, citizens cannot go to court over these rights. And this is an important distinction. We do have programs in the U.S. to help feed people. We have the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program that used to be called food stamps. These programs are very important, but they're far more vulnerable, and access to them is far more difficult than they would be if they were supported with a legal underpinning that access to food is a human right. In Brazil, the right to food is now part of the national constitution. In Nepal, the right to food has recently been incorporated into its new constitution. Vandana, do you see the idea that food is a basic human right spreading globally?
Well, as you mentioned, it was recognized when the UN Declaration of Human Rights was written. And India has a Food Security Act, which obliges the government to let no one go hungry, to be responsible. But the problem is we are living through a period where all the rights built into our constitutions and the international legally binding system of the United Nations are being dismantled through this crazy free trade system. The global agribusiness, using the U.S. government, has sued India in the WTO for its Food Security Act and the government procurement that must be done to store enough food to get to the people. So we are seeing these two ideologies totally clashing with each other. One ideology sees food as a commodity, pump it with toxics, that doesn't matter, let people die, that doesn't matter, maximize profits, that's all that matters. On the other hand, you've got the recognition that food is a right, not just for human beings. In my view, every species has to eat and must have their right to food and right to safe food. That's why we cannot kill the bees with the use of neonicotinoids in agriculture. The right to food of all species, the right to food of humans as a human right, is something we must continue to struggle for, because these dark times will pass not automatically if we just stand as bystanders doing nothing, but every ugly period of history, when responded to through our deepest humanity as citizens of one earth family, we do create a better world.
We have, and may we continue to. Vandana, you remind me of the innocent child who pointed out the truth that the fearful adults were pretending not to see.
Innocent child forever, even when I'm 80 years old.
Even when you're 80 years old, with all the sophisticated knowledge that you have, you know, you're pointing out that the fable that GMOs are feeding the world has led to large-scale destruction of biodiversity, to farmers' livelihoods, to the health of humanity, and of other species. And what's more, it's a fable that's threatening the very basis of our freedom to know what we eat and to choose what we eat. You're showing us how much is at stake today, and how much depends on the food choices we make and the food agricultural systems that we support. You're showing us that our biodiversity and our seed freedom are in peril, and that we cannot take for granted our food freedom, our food democracy, or our food sovereignty. You are inspiring us. You are activating us. You are mobilizing us, and you're loving us. And I love you for it, Vandana.
I love you too, John.
It's always a privilege to talk with you. And on behalf of Ocean and myself and everyone involved in the Food Revolution Network, I want to thank you for your wisdom, your passion, your knowledge, your innocence, and your love, and for being with us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Vandana Shiva, founder of Navdanya, which can be found at navdanya.org, and one of the world's leading voices for social justice and environmental sanity in our food systems.
And one of my favorite people on the planet.
Vandana, you are a courageous voice in challenging the militarization and corporate takeover of the world's food supplies. And you're also a powerful advocate for healthy, life-affirming, biodiverse communities and ecosystems. Your work is an inspiration to millions, and we thank you for it. It's been a great honor to share this time with you and to share your message with our listeners.
Bye, John and Ocean.
Bye-bye, Vandana.
Bye. Thank you so much. This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.